Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
During the first week of March, students and teachers took to the streets in protest of the massive budget cuts and fee hikes affecting public education across the state. University of California President Mark Udolph has been the target of some protests. But in Sacramento, Udolph is applying some pressure of his own. Kate McLean was there.
Protesters rallied outside the state capitol, but inside, the main event was a day of lobbying by UC students, regents, and top brass, a rare collaboration.
You know, we don't agree on everything, and so what we do is we figure out what we do agree on, and that's what we push for.
What they agree on is that UC needs more money, and they asked for it in a meeting with the governor.
We did ask, you know, and his point of view was, you know, I need to reform the budget and the tax system, but anything we save, you're first in line. I mean, that's more or less what he said.
But with a projected state deficit of $20 billion, lawmakers aren't making any promises.
Don't come here, whoever you are, and tell us, got to have more money. Fund my program. There is no money in the bank. Come and tell us how you can do your job better, more efficiently.
We're trying to make lemonade out of the lemons. We're trying to do the best we can with a very difficult set of circumstances.
While Udolph and his colleagues visited legislators, some students took matters into their own hands and staged a sit-in at Senate Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg's office.
Nobody can say no to education because the practical value of it is just so obvious.
We can't. We can no longer sit by while we get cut again and again and again.
Education needs to be a priority.
And Steinberg offered to meet them halfway.
What if we work together and as a follow-up to this meeting, you sit down with our budget team and We can help educate you, you can help inform us, and we can maybe come up with an idea or a proposal together.
Students, I thought the students were great. Smart, articulate, they were, I thought, persuasive, went from office to office. It was a movable feast. I think they impressed the members.
And with the possibility of more cuts down the line, the UC lobbyists will be back in Sacramento soon. For CNS News, I'm Kate McLean.
Brooke Minters followed a group of African-American students who staged a walkout to silently protest the recent racist incidents on a UC campus.
During a week of protest at Berkeley, 200 African-American students staged something different. They called it a blackout.
We walked out dressed in black, our faces covered, our mouths covered, and we blocked off Sathergate to exemplify the silence that we feel every day.
While their silence stopped foot traffic, it did not shut down the campus. Amber Booth, one of the protesters, later explained.
We're not going to make it easy for you to get through, just like some people haven't made it easy for us to come through.
Stephen Montooth was one of the blackout's organizers.
We don't agree with the budget cuts. We don't agree with the recent spike in tuition. It really affects the black community and other minority groups disproportionately, but that was definitely a separate issue.
The silent protest came as a reaction to a party at UC San Diego, which mocked Black History Month. The organizers of the party called it a Compton cookout, and the invite for the party appeared to be blatantly racist and sexist.
They asked everybody to act ghetto like black people act. All black people have short, nappy hair. All black people have a limited vocabulary, so all they do is cuss. All black people eat chicken, watermelon, and Kool-Aid.
If, you know, people spoke out more, not just black people, but all people against forms of racism, this wouldn't be happening. And what happened in San Diego, I doubt would be happening.
San Diego's off-campus party further frustrated black Berkeley students, who make up only 3.5% of the student body. When the campanile struck two, protesters went to the chancellor's office to object to the administration's letter response to the San Diego party.
The black community at UC Berkeley finds a letter to the campus on February 24th dismissive and disappointing.
We said we wanted to work to prevent incidents in the future, and they read that we didn't think there were incidents going on now.
Gabor Basri is the first vice chancellor of equity and inclusion, a position created in 2007.
I think the students would feel safer. If there were more black students here, there'd be more of a community. People wouldn't feel as isolated and exposed.
Students agree, but few feel they will see an increase in black enrollment. This is Brooke Minters for CNS News.
On March 4th, thousands of students took to the streets to fight for public education while legislators and lobbyists met in Sacramento to secure more funding for California schools. Josh Wolf has the story.
Of the Daily File, Secretary will please read.
It was partisan politics as usual on the Senate floor. But just outside, hundreds flocked to the state capitol to take part in the March 4th National Day of Action for Public Education.
I got the California, Pennsylvania, passes blue. Can you reach her?
Students demonstrated on campuses all over California and throughout the country.
It's time to say no to the privatization of public services, and in particular of public education.
In Berkeley, students gathered shortly after sunrise and formed a human barricade at Sather Gate.
This is not just something that is happening at the UCs. It's happening all across the state, it's happening all across the country, and it's happening all across the world. And
one group went room to room to urge on their classmates. After a brief rally at Bancroft and Telegraph, the crowd departed on a five-mile march to Frankagawa Plaza in Oakland.
We're celebrating the right to an equitable, just education.
Along the way, many young students joined in the protest.
We're fighting for budget cuts in California. We lost our PE teacher. It's amazing how many people care.
Eventually, the march met up with a rally outside Oakland City Hall.
Later on, around 5 o'clock, there was a group of about 100, 150 individuals that splintered off. And once they got into the freeway, it was about 100, 125 individuals. They blocked the northbound freeway of 980, and then they crossed over to the southbound side. We didn't have to move in and make arrests. They forced our hand.
A 15-year-old student fell more than 25 feet after he tried to escape police by shimmying down a tree. He suffered a fractured skull.
Over 100 policemen jumping on people, hurting them, throwing them against the ground, scaring someone enough that they would jump off the freeway. Why would you jump off the freeway?
But no matter how many people join the battle for public education, they will not secure more funding until the legislature can overcome the budget impasse.
We have to change the two-thirds vote requirement in California, not just to pass a budget, but also to raise taxes and revenues that we need to invest in California.
We can't afford increased taxes on California's working families right now. And despite the rhetoric that, well, it's just going to hit big corporations, we know that every tax is passed down to the consumer in some fashion or another.
Still, student activists say they will continue the fight.
Well, I think that nobody really expects that to wake up tomorrow and see that the fee hikes have been rolled back or that the regions have been magically democratized. What we do hope is that tomorrow we wake up to see a new viable national movement.
This is Josh Wolf for CNS News.
Small businesses across the country are succumbing to the pressures of today's weak economy. But black-owned businesses, like those in Oakland's Black Wall Street district, face an added set of challenges. Sade McDougal reports.
Last year, Eltina McCree was Entrepreneur of the Year in Oakland's Black Wall Street district. Now she's on the brink of losing her shop.
I am holding on by a thread right now. It's sad because I've been here 17 years.
Her business is one of 550 that are part of Oakland's Black Wall Street Merchants Association. Eltina is struggling despite her efforts to make things work.
I moved another black-owned business in with me in the summer of 2008. Well, she lost her job. She lost her income property. She lost her home. So I'm about $5,000 in the hole right now, suffering from back rent.
Black store owners established the district in 1998 along Oakland's International Boulevard and beyond.
You've got Black Wall Streets all over America, and all of them are in jeopardy.
David Glover says black businesses need more capital to succeed.
Every time a business needs a capital improvement, or every time a business needs a facade improvement, or maybe it's just an emergency injection loan, it's not always there.
Today, International Boulevard is home to many different businesses based on ethnicity, Mexican, Chinese, Italian, as well as black. And experts say highlighting the city's diversity may be one way to help all Oakland shop owners.
Redevelopment helps build healthy communities.
Elisa Gallo works to develop small businesses in Oakland.
What we are trying to do by working with our merchant associations like the Black Wall Street is to make sure they have the information and the training so that they can in turn provide it to their merchant groups and their merchant members.
The long-term goal is to bring Oakland residents back home to shop in local districts.
The tendency these days is to run to the mall. And when customers run to the mall, they basically are taking money directly out of the cash register of the local Black business.
Neighborhood shopping means better tax revenues for the city, more jobs, and for some, new hope.
Right now, it's just not a bright forecast, but we continue to hope and believe that it's going to happen.
This is Sade McDougal for CNS News.
Taxi drivers across Oakland claim in the past year they've had an increase in parking tickets. June Stinson got the story.
Oakland cab drivers say business, already shaky, has gotten even worse in the past year, with increased parking violation enforcement in a city with too few places for them to park.
You can ask any every cab driver, they tell you the same answer, like we are struggling to make our living because the business is really slow and there are no cab stands, no business like it used to be.
There are 304 registered Oakland cabs on the streets and 24 cab stands. That's one cab stand for every 13 taxis.
And if you're waiting on the meter, you cannot even park on the meter even you're paying the meter. And they still give you a ticket for the $80 to $293.
To most people, you know, having a pole, a meter, or a taxi stand put in, pulled out seems like a very simple endeavor. But for us, each and every one of those steps has a cost.
On any given day, cab drivers can be seen double parking and waiting for fares on 13th Street and Broadway, where only two cab stands exist.
One day I was parking on a meter. I'm coming from buying a coffee, and I found the officer writing a ticket. I asked him, "Why do you write me a ticket? There is money in the meter. Why do you write a ticket on me?" He said, "You are parked illegally." "What is illegal means?" I asked him. He said, "You are a taxi, and you are soliciting a fare here."
The Oakland Police Department says cabs should not be getting ticketed for parking at meters. But if police suspect they're looking for fares, they can be fined.
We're part of the, you know, public transportation. We're not hurting anybody. We're not criminals. You know, I mean, we want to make a living like everybody else. This is our living. So we need a break.
The city administrator's office says they're working on getting 10 new stands installed within the next 6 months. This is June Stinson for CNS News.
Some East Bay cities are changing the way their elections are run, and voters will be faced with a new, and perhaps confusing, ballot. Lauren Callahan explains.
For years, shows like Schoolhouse Rock have been teaching children and adults the importance of fulfilling their civic duties, such as voting.
It's simple, right? You walk into the voting booth, pull the lever, push the button, or fill in the bubble. But when residents of Oakland and Berkeley go to the polls this fall, they'll be looking at an entirely new ballot, a ranked choice ballot, that they must figure out how to use.
The new ballot has three columns, with all the candidates listed in each of them. You rank the candidates in order of your preference. 1, 2, 3, and you're done. For the voter, it's that simple. For the city and county, things become complicated if no one wins the election in the first round of voting. Let's say that, in our mock election, our leading candidate only receives 45% of the vote in the first round. The person who receives the fewest votes is eliminated, and their second-choice votes are distributed between the remaining candidates. The first candidate to receive a majority of the vote wins. Alameda County Registrar of Voters, Dave McDonald, says that the new ballot will not only save the city the cost of running two elections, it should also increase turnout.
One of the advantages, of course, is we have more people vote in a November election versus a June primary.
Berkeley City Council member Gordon Wozniak opposes changing the ballots. He says the savings will be eaten up by new costs.
So right there it says there's going to be additional costs. The ranked choice voting set of costs are in addition to the normal costs of conducting an election on each city's behalf.
request for that needed education campaign, McDonald said his office is preparing sample ballots and brochures to send to every registered voter, and they're planning to hold at least 100 town hall meetings before the election. But, he stresses, the real education push will happen closer to the election, when people are paying attention.
You know, this is one of those things, you don't want to do it too early, and you don't want to do it just prior to the election. So I think we'll start, we haven't worked out all the details yet, but our real hard push will be starting in the summer.
To inspire people to go and vote.
And the few people who came to the Berkeley City Council meeting will be there to help.
We're all determined to make the November 2010 election a success.
In Berkeley, this is Lauren Callahan for CNS News.
There will be an estimated 13 million foreclosures between the end of 2008 and 2014. But some first-time homebuyers are finding houses are much more affordable. Veronica Moscoso has more.
Yeah, any way I could look at it today?
David Weekends is now able to do what he thought impossible, buy a home in the Bay Area.
Anyone who's looking for a house right now, oh man, you're one of the lucky ones. Now you have a chance.
I think that almost anywhere is a good place to buy right now, just because prices are so good and the interest rates are so good.
With the interest rates so low right now, sometimes your purchasing power will actually go up a little bit.
In some neighborhoods, you'll see homes that are selling for half.
To top it all, some first-time homebuyers are eligible for an $8,000 tax credit.
And now that that credit has been extended, I think that's going to extend, you know, this current buying cycle a little bit further.
But there are challenges when buying a home. The rules of the game of getting loans has changed.
So now you're actually having to prove your qualifications. You're having to go through the full process.
And you need to have good credit. David is approved for a loan that allows him to put a down payment of only 3%.
I got an FHA loan approval, and that's good. And so my ball is really rolling now.
But there's another challenge. Affordable houses are in high demand.
Many of my clients are ending up, you know, going through the process of actually finding a home that they like, doing the research, structuring a correct offer, and then, you know, maybe it's not getting accepted, or you get outbid, or someone comes in, you know, with better financial terms.
David hasn't been able to buy a home even after a year of looking, but he remains optimistic.
When you retire, you'll have a house that's paid for. And you're like, well, there's a big crash, and I snuck in then, and I got a house.
For CNS News, this is Veronica Moscoso.
With help from her East Oakland neighborhood, a woman compels a bank to modify her loan and stay in her home. Thomas Gorman reports.
After 35 years, Dewina Coleman may lose her home in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood. Her grandparents built the house back in 1961, but unless U.S. Bank modifies Dewina's mortgage, her house will be auctioned in April.
I want to stay. You know, it's important for me to stay. It's important. My sister will be delivering very shortly. She'll be the fourth generation to be in this house, and it's important.
If Dewina moves, hers would be the fourth empty house on the block. Her neighbor Steve Gilbert is working to hold the neighborhood together.
When I first moved here 30-some-odd years ago, there was almost 30 kids on the block at that time. And you can see the pictures here. We pulled together, and we have maintained a very cohesive and warm and friendly neighborhood, and this is being torn apart.
Dewina's original lender collapsed 2 years ago and was sold to U.S. Bank. The FDIC required them to modify loans like Dewina's if they met the requirements. But she says working with U.S. Bank has been challenging.
And I'm like, well, what is it that, what is needed? And, you know, he says, I can't give you that information. And I'm like, well, why not? This is my loan.
The nonprofit California Reinvestment Coalition recently found that U.S. Bank modified one loan for every 22 Oakland foreclosures in 2009. To put pressure on the bank, Steve and Dewina distributed flyers and petitions and called local media to demand that U.S. Bank fulfill its obligation to modify the loan. Somebody noticed. Not long after Dewina was interviewed, she received a surprising call from U.S. Bank.
You know, that they go ahead and approve the modification. And it's amazing. It's amazing. I'm speechless.
U.S. Bank hasn't responded to interview requests, but the neighbors are now firm believers that the pressure they put on the bank worked.
And hopefully people can see that they can do this. They don't have to just let their neighborhoods be destroyed or let their homes be taken away. We can be victorious.
Clearly, this is a day of relief for Dawina Coleman, her family, and her block. But there are thousands of families still in Oakland who are wondering whether they'll stay in their homes. For CNS News, this is Thomas Coleman.
Oakley resident Arthur Maharez is determined to purge the devil from a beloved East Bay landmark, Mount Diablo. Richard Parks reports.
Derogatory, pejorative, blasphemous, obscene. You say the word devil, he is the arch enemy of Christianity.
The devil didn't make it, but it is named for him, as are streets, schools, even churches. It's Mount Diablo. Spanish for Mount Devil.
The devil does nothing but rob, cheat, steal, and kill.
Boasting an isolated upthrust of nearly 4,000 feet, Mount Diablo is visible from around the Bay Area. Arthur Mijares is on a holy quest to purge the beloved mount of its evil appellation and give it a new name, a better name, a proper name, Mount Reagan.
A proper name to call the mountain. I think his record speaks for itself.
This isn't the first time Arthur Mijares has tried to rename the beloved mount. Several years ago, the devout Christian's attempt to rename it Mount Yahweh was beaten down. Will Mount Reagan be any more successful?
Mijares presented his case last month to the Board of Supervisors in Martinez, bringing with him copies of Merriam-Webster's definition of devil and a couple supporters. His deeply unpopular idea had already led to public outcry and a Facebook page against the renaming with more than 80,000 members. On the day of the meeting, Mijares appeared undeterred.
What do you say to the people who call you a fanatic?
You have a right to your opinion?
And despite Mijares' best efforts, the crowd was unmoved. And the supervisors, unconvinced.
There has been a mountain of emails received here and a mountain of support for retaining the existing naming.
I sort of see three reasons to keep the name.
We oppose any name change.
The devil may have won this round, but Mijares promises to fight on.
Will you ever give up?
Till he comes, no. I have a task. Why am I driven? I have a task from Almighty God.
I'm Richard Parks for CNS News.
In January, wildlife rescue workers were surprised by a sudden increase in illness and death of a bird species that just last year was removed from the endangered species list. Vanessa Carr investigates.
Hundreds of brown pelicans, normally hardy and adaptable seabirds, were found listless and near death on beaches from Oregon to San Diego.
They were all over the place. I mean, 30, 40 birds a day. I think at one point there were 80 birds coming in.
Mark Russell rehabilitates birds at the International Bird Rescue Research Center in Fairfield. They've cared for more than 100 pelicans this year.
We're getting cold, hypothermic, starved birds in very, very large numbers. They're historically large numbers.
Many of the birds were covered with an unidentified oily residue that separated their feathers, exposing them to cold ocean water.
Because his waterproofing is not that great, and he's been out here for a while, we're going to bring him inside.
First, rescuers wash and dry them.
So the dark one, it's just the water's being absorbed into the feather. That absorption decreases the thermoregulation.
In addition to suffering from hypothermia, the pelicans were also starving. This meant the birds needed lots of supportive care. Dryers, IV fluids, antibiotics, and upwards of 10 pounds of fish a day. Scientists mobilized to find both why the pelicans are starving and what is fouling their feathers.
We're at the Department of Fish and Game's Fish and Wildlife Water Pollution Control Laboratory. We're just one small part of the investigation. We're performing the chemical analysis.
It's not anything to do with algae or algal bloom or toxins. It's not. And also it's not oil, so that has been ruled out.
As chemists work to find the source of the feather residue, biologists struggle to determine what is causing the starvation.
The storms were very big that hit in early January, and they hit all along the Pacific coast.
Biologist Esther Burkett says changing ocean currents make it harder for pelicans to find food.
Those storms have really high winds, colder weather, causes a lot of sediment to be swirled about within the water, and that can affect fish movements.
Scientists hope to have more answers soon. For now, the storms have calmed and the number of birds needing care has dropped. Thanks to rescuers, most of the birds they've treated have been returned to the wild.
If you can just get nutrition in them and fluid in them and get them warm, they generally perk up really well.
Still, Burkett estimates a death toll of 500 pelicans along California's coast so far. This is Vanessa Carr for CNS News.
For centuries, Zen practitioners have sought inner peace through meditation. Some get their kicks elsewhere. Alyssa Figueroa has the story of a new kind of Zen gaining ground in Oakland.
Ron Chu has always felt as comfortable here as he does here. He's a devout Buddhist spiritualist and an NRA-certified pistol instructor. Last month, he began teaching Zen meditation.
To describe it, you know, you almost don't have any thoughts, but you're aware of your whole surroundings.
But two students use guns instead of prayer beads.
With marksmanship, you can actually, at the moment, get very deep with that, where it's almost a one-pointed trance-like state just before the hammer drops.
Chu's new take on meditation is based on the same principles as Japanese Zen archery, a practice that gained popularity in the 1950s. Angela Du had never held a firearm before meeting Chu.
I definitely had a little bit of excitement and also very nervous, because when Ron handed me the real gun, I was like, wow, it's a gun, it's a real gun. And what should I do next?
If someone hands you a firearm, it's a charged object. You're either going to like it, you're going to be excited, you're not, you're going to hate it, something. But it stirs up things right away, and because of that, you're engaged. So my point is, use that to work with yourself.
There you go. You got it? You got the stance? Go ahead. Just go ahead and drop the hammer.
I've been sitting here watching this for a little while, so I'm going to give it a shot, and I'm a little nervous because it's really loud. And when people shoot, you can actually see the fire and the casings popping out, and it's intimidating.
It's frustrating.
So yeah, guys. It's not about the bullet, Chu teaches. It's about making a mind-body connection. I'm not sure I reached the Zen state, but I hit the target. This is Alyssa Figueroa for CNS News.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.